You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, April 27th, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Yale historian Frank Snowden. His book, Epidemics and Society from Black Death to the Present. Meanwhile, Republicans fretting a presidential and Senate lost. And Trump threatening the post office unless it hikes costs, cuts union. We're looking at a tsunami of bankruptcies building as loans to millionaires revealed in the last version of the PPP. Biden, meanwhile, insists he'd pursue a much, much more generous bailout. A 27-year-old Larry King episode substantiates at least a part of Biden accuser Tara Reid's claims. Mike Pompeo looking for UN action against Iran, claiming they broke the deal that Donald Trump broke. And USDA incompetence has let millions of pounds of food rot while bread lines, food bank lines, I should say, demand soars. Rent strike, can't pay, won't pay, being organized by Housing Justice for All. And Trump insisting that 1,000 West Point cadets return to New York State to hear the speech that he's going to give for graduation. All that and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. It is another Monday. And we are endeavoring to persevere. I will tell you right up front that the screaming you may have heard in the background of Friday's show has continued unabating in my household, and you may hear again today. We were just I was just sharing that with Matt and Brendan before the show started. Hope your weekend went well. We are still basically in the midst of things. Georgia, a couple other states have, I guess, I want to say opened up. It's not really the right word. They have relaxed their stay-at-home rules basically so that they can get out from under their unemployment obligations and support for local businesses. That's basically the dynamic that we're looking at. We are nearing 55,000 deaths in this country. We were told by the administration that the models all said 60,000 tops. Of course, we've reached that in less than 5 weeks from when they told us that. Fortunately, it appears in New York that things may have at least plateaued, maybe slightly gone down for the past couple of days. But it's difficult to sort of measure these things that precisely. So we will see. On Wednesday, we're going to play the interview I did with one of the country's top epidemiologists who really at least lays out broad strokes, you know, what we can expect and what we're going to need to do as a country. But frankly, I don't know that we have the leadership coming from any quarters at this point providing any of that. Donald Trump is a lunatic aided and abetted by the Republican Party. We'll get into, you know, his response to his own claiming that people should inject themselves with bleach or clean out their insides or get super, super ultraviolet light. But make no mistake about this, folks. And this, and the Democrats have been just horrible at this. Horrible. What we are dealing with is not just Donald Trump's insanity and incompetence. What we're dealing with is unfettered Republican governance. There was, Matt Iglesias tweeted out something where he retweeted the former head of the FDA, who had written in January, we need to ramp up antibody testing for coronavirus. He wrote this in January in an op-ed. Now, he did so when he was out of office because he was pushed out of office because Grover Norquist, he of Club for Growth, wanted him out because of what he was saying about vaping. About vaping. You remember Donald Trump when Alex Azar, who apparently now Health and Human Services, apparently they're looking for a replacement for him. When he tried to get Donald Trump's attention in January over the coronavirus, Trump was still obsessed about the vaping. When do we get the vaping back? When the admiral who sat on the National Security Council to coordinate pandemic response for this country and oversaw essentially a small agency to do that very same thing, his position was eliminated. It wasn't because Donald Trump woke up in the middle of the night. It was like, oh my gosh, we're just spending too much on pandemic readiness. It was because of Republican ideology. It was because John Bolton wanted the guy out. A waste of time. Donald Trump did not assemble this crew of cronies. Mike Pence did. All of the Republicans who are put in there, short of like, you know, the roommate, Jared's roommate or Alex Azar's, you know, good buddy who used to raise labradoodles, is now in charge of our pandemic response. These people were staffed by Republicans. And so keep in mind that what we're seeing is all along the line in terms of our readiness, in terms of our response, these are all policy choices. There were bad ones, but it was a policy choice made by a Republican administration. Not incompetence. Somebody didn't forget, oh, you know, I was supposed to renew his contract to sit on the National Security Council. And I just got caught up in so much stuff this weekend, I couldn't get to it. And then I realized I hadn't renewed it, and then he got a different job, and I screwed up. No, these were all choices. And when we, and these choices, in terms of the response, I don't know if Nancy Pelosi is just incompetent or what, but I don't know if we have time to play the sound. We'll get to this. But somebody wrote me the other day when I was critical of Nancy Pelosi. And I would turn their attention to the panic that other Democrats in the House are sounding about the complete unpreparedness to deal with any of this. And now Nancy Pelosi's finally feeling a little bit of heat and going on and getting incredibly defensive about it. Well, good. I hope she gets more defensive about it because they screwed up. I was in a good mood a couple of minutes ago. I don't know what happened. Folks, we got a little quick plugs and notices, just two things. This will be, we will put the links underneath the description of the podcast and this YouTube. Two things. One is there's a friend of the show is organizing the collection of N95 masks, face protectors, and shields, and people who have 3D printers, hazmat suits, incubator protective acrylic box, gowns, hair and head coverings, shoe coverings. They are being distributed to different people on in hospitals in New York City. And you can email Rachel at rchaos@chaosbuilt.com. Also, a friend of the show is looking for information. And this is just an appeal to those of you out there. I don't know. I said something about my sound and I got about 50 emails, but hopefully there's some folks who know about this. We're looking for info on a service dog or emotional support dog for a child with special needs. I'm looking for sourcing and for perhaps funding resources. If you're familiar with any of that, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put the word dog in the subject line. Obviously, these situations are causing a lot of stress for people in general with kids. Those kids with who are atypical in some ways or have any type of special needs, it becomes that much harder. So if anybody has any information about that, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Next up, I'm really happy to support this organization. This ad is a warning. Our democracy is under attack from the U.S. Supreme Court. In the middle of a deadly global pandemic, people across Wisconsin are planning on voting absentee to keep themselves and their families safe. But the night before the election, five Republican justices on the Supreme Court told thousands of people they'd have to choose between risking their lives and forfeiting their right to vote. Supreme Court favoring Republican interests over our democracy is nothing new. They've gutted the Voting Rights Act. They invited billionaires and corporations to spend unlimited amounts trying to influence our elections. They gave a green light to gerrymandering, green light to voter ID laws, green light to voter roll purges. And now a progressive movement is rising up to fight back because it's quite possible the Wisconsin case won't be the last 2020 showdown over voting rights to be settled in the courts. We simply cannot trust this court to put aside partisan views and protect people's right to vote. Our courts are becoming too political. It's time to say enough. Learn more about how you can join the fight by visiting demandjustice.org/majority. That's demandjustice.org/majority. This is, it's a great organization. Really important. Really important. I spoke about what the ED, Brian Fallon, said. I mentioned it the other day. I've said it in the past on here. He wants to make sure that the next Democratic president appoints no corporate lawyers to the federal judiciary. It's time that we start to break up that that monopoly on some level that they have. Meanwhile, finding the perfect present for mom, always tough, especially if you don't have the luxury of celebrating Mother's Day together in person, which a lot of people, I know, myself included, maintaining social distance from our parents because of their health and to protect their health. However, you can give your gift, you can gift your mom the chance to connect with loved ones through StoryWorth. I've told you people in the past that my folks, I've given them StoryWorth. It's over a year now, I think. And I will say that basically the way it works is that StoryWorth, they send your loved ones, doesn't have to be just your mom, but they send your loved ones. It's a service that basically prompts them to answer questions or to just jog memories so that they share stories on a weekly basis. It's obviously, it's fun. It's meaningful. It is great for relatives you don't see often. It's great for older relatives. It's great to, so you have something for your kids to see what you're, you know, and you learn stuff as a kid yourself. They get stories like, they get questions like, you know, what was one of the greatest surprises you ever got? What was your favorite, I don't know, car as a kid or something like that? Things that just jog the memory. And then you read the weekly stories on a weekly basis. And then after a year, Storyworth will compile all the answers and photos into a beautiful keepsake book that's shipped for free. Something your family will treasure forever. And in this instance, it's also, you know, a good way to keep in touch. You go over the stories. And, you know, my mom is having some memory issues. And so, this has been, helpful and interesting. It's a process and, but it's going to be very worth it at the end. You can give your mom the most meaningful gift this year with Storyworth. Get started right away without the need for shipping by going to storyworth.com/majority. You get $10 off your first purchase. That's storyworth.com/majority for $10 off. And lastly, got a lot of time at home? Well, take advantage of it, whether alone or with others, with the break, with the breakout, Hunt a Killer. This murder mystery game is the best way to switch things up from constantly watching TV and scrolling on your phone. Hunt a Killer reinvents the way that we interact with murder mysteries. You go from being viewer safe in the comfort of your own home to an investigator actively working to solve the case. It's a murder mystery subscription box that has over 2,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot. With each delivery, you sift through a pile of documents, evidence, audio recordings, case files, eliminating suspects until you crack the case. You can even join Hunt a Killer's spoiler-free online community, has over 100,000 members, so you can share theories and help each other out. Plus, part of the proceeds of every box goes to the Cold Case Foundation. I can tell you, this is a game that Milo and I have been playing for some time now, and it's great. You get like a new episode every month, and we've got the... Fortunately, we don't have our bulletin board up here, but I brought all the case files and you crack a case and then a new season starts. It's a great way to get the kid off of her phone for, I don't know, an hour, 2 hours, which is huge, believe me, on any given evening. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority. Use promo code majority at checkout for 20% off your first box. Head to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off your first box. Head to huntakiller.com for 20% off and show your support for this podcast. That's huntakiller.com/majority. All right, folks.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Please use no speaker phone and have your one comment or question ready.
I'm just calling
Listen
into the
for Sam to call out your area code. Sam will be with you shortly.
Okay. Here we go. Oh. Oh, bear with me, sir.
Hello?
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Back after this. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Emeritus History, Emeritus Professor of History, History of Medicine from Yale University, author of Epidemics and Society from Black Death to the Present, Yale historian Frank Snowden. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm delighted to be here.
And we're speaking to you. I believe you're in Rome. Is that right? You were obviously pursuing some research at the time, and got stuck.
You're absolutely right. I am in Rome. I came to do research actually on a different topic, and I did get upended by coronavirus. And in fact, I also not only had lockdown, but I also was in quarantine at home because I actually caught the virus as well. Now I'm just reassessing exactly what and when my travel plans will be.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're feeling okay and that you're that's what you're contemplating. So let's jump into your book, and I know that you've been rather busy as of late because of the book and coronavirus. You write that epidemics hold a mirror up to society. Tease that out for us.
Yes, I'd be delighted to do that. I believe that the diseases that afflict a society are not random events, that in fact, we as a people, we create the channels that microbes exploit in as they move and challenge us as a people. To make the point, I might make a contrast between two separate times. Let's take first, very briefly, the Industrial Revolution and imagine the chaos of the industrial cities, which are filling with people from the countryside in an unplanned, frenetic way, so that there's overcrowding, their hygiene is rock bottom, there are no building regulations, people live in cramped and extraordinary tenements that Dickens describes, with no running water, no safe drinking water, no sewage systems, none of that. It's in that sort of place and environment, that stage of evolution of our society, that diseases that are spread by the oral fecal route, like Asiatic cholera and typhoid, thrive. Since then, we have no longer live in that world, and typhoid and cholera, because of the sanitary revolution, we have eliminated those paths for those microbes to reach us. And so you may have occasional cases, mostly travelers, but you don't have the possibility of those being big killers in New York, let us say, or Rome. We now contrast that with the era of globalization, and that has not made us immune to these afflictions. It's simply we live inevitably in a world of microbes, and it's a different group of microbes that are now able to challenge us successfully. We've created through globalization, we have now, we're overpopulated. We're nearly 8 billion people in the globe. And we also have an industrial society in which we seem to believe that industrial growth infinitely is possible, although the resources of the planet are finite. Those two premises together mean that we're destroying the environment around us in a rapacious and unprecedented manner, and that means we're destroying animal habitat. That, in turn, means that people come into contact with animals with whom they would not have had such contact, either frequently or at all, in the past, and that sets the stage for what we see now of ever-increasing numbers of spillover events in which from animals that are reservoirs for various pathogens, these pathogens now come into contact with people who have contact with those animals. That is the origin of the coronavirus pandemic in Wuhan. Then we have to imagine major cities and those cities teeming and crowded and all linked by rapid air transport, with that millions of people were constantly in motion, so that a microbe that, let us say, picking a place at random on the planet at Jakarta experiences in the morning will have broken out in New York or Rome or Los Angeles by evening. And so if you put all of that together, we have now created pathways from animals we didn't know or rather have contact with in the past for those microbes to expand. They broke out in Wuhan among shoppers at a market where they had bats. The shoppers took those microbes home with them, and they contaminated their environment at home, and it spread in clusters in apartments and apartment buildings, and then moved beyond that to neighborhoods and then whole cities. Then those microbes were, because they're spread by air, and were very vulnerable, therefore, to pulmonary viruses that are spread through the air, they were readily transmitted, and they were transmitted across the globe. And so we see this disease, to which, as a globalized society, we're extraordinarily vulnerable, is now spreading relentlessly across the globe. That's a very quick idea of how this disease is now demonstrating who we are as a global, unequal, densely populated urban civilization.
I want to stay with sort of the bigger picture, but I just want to add what I learned. The Ebola virus was literally just that, literally somebody on the edge, a child on the edge of expansion and being exposed to, I guess it was fecal matter from bats or something.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. In fact, I would say that isn't there a message here for us that we've had avian flu a number of times beginning in 1997, and we've had MERS, we've had SARS, we've had Ebola, we have the coronavirus. The point is, these are all airborne. These are all pathogens that begin. Sorry, not all airborne. Ebola is not. But those are all pathogens that begin with animal reservoirs. And if the Ebola began, as you were talking about, with deforestation in West Africa and bats that had lived in the canopy of the forest, when that was gone, they moved close to animal, to human habitations. And what happened was a four-year-old boy was playing in the hollow of a tree where bats had found refuge and were roosting, nesting in the thousands, and with their excrement dropping down to the bottom of the tree, the boy breathed in the virus, and he then took it home, and it then spread to his family, neighbors, and the neighbors worked in the big city, and so soon you had this, that's the origin of all of the cases in West Africa in the Ebola epidemic there.
And so, I mean, I've read some of your book. The idea of human beings just being sort of like almost like a circuit, and the society that we build at any given time, the way that we're organizing, just changes the path of the circuit essentially. Is that why we get pandemics, or is that why the pandemics like this are sometimes, sort of clustered on some level, because society sort of responds to the way that it is made up and the circuit that it's created for something like this to pass? And then over time, it starts to go further in a different direction that creates new vulnerabilities?
I would like what you said, 90% I'm very enthusiastic. I do believe we create the circuits exactly as you said, and microbes exploit those, and the circuits that are created depend on the world that we've created. Epidemics are not hitting us randomly. They are exploiting fault lines that we ourselves have created. But what I wanted to add to that, that I think is critical, particularly looking at today's events, is that this is not something that was doomed to happen. What happens when we're challenged, the challenge was inevitable, but there was every possibility of being prepared for this particular challenge, this what has now become a pandemic of coronavirus. We have been receiving warnings from epidemiologists, virologists, public health officials for 25 years, well, since not quite, since 1997, all saying that an event like this was inevitable. To me, the most disturbing sentence, actually a question of the entire outbreak, was the question phrased by President Trump, in which he asked, who could have known? In my opinion, everyone should have known, because the world was warned. We had a number of, if you like, dress rehearsals with avian flu, SARS, Ebola, MERS. In 2005, we had testimony before Congress, which was considering a pandemic emergency. And it's extraordinary to read now. They actually more or less predicted what we're now facing,
right?
That Fauci, in fact, and the director general then of the CDC, Julie Gerberding, actually testified before the Senate, and they used the analogy of a hurricane. They said that if you live in the Caribbean, meteorologists can tell you that a hurricane is coming. Scientifically, it's certain. They can't tell you when and how strong the hurricane will be, but they know that it's coming. They said in exactly the same way, virologists can tell you that a pulmonary pandemic challenge is coming. They can't tell you how terrible it will be, and they can't give you a date, but it's coming is inevitable. And just as in the hurricane situation, it would be extremely important to prepare for it. And that's, in fact, what we didn't do.
Right.
There was a flurry of preparation in 2005-07, a flurry around Ebola, but then everything went back literally to business as usual with cost cutting and all of the vulnerabilities. So I would say that this is a catastrophe of unpreparedness as much as it is simply of an epidemic challenge that was inevitable. The point is we did very, very little, too late and too little to prevent it. This was a preventable pandemic.
And just to reiterate, when you say pulmonary, it's that is an indication on some level that we shored up as a world, I guess, broadly speaking, issues of sanitation. And like, you know, just like basic, I guess, hygiene on some level, right? I mean, because if we still had that problem, we'd be susceptible to something that would be more transmittable through such means. But because we closed off that avenue, or not just because we closed off that avenue, but because we're susceptible to air issues, and our air travels literally from, like you say, from Jakarta to Chicago in an airplane, then we're susceptible to something like that.
That's right. We are susceptible exactly to something like that. It was what's scary about 2005-07 and listening now to Fauci and to Gerberding is that they actually identify specifically that this will be a pulmonary pandemic virus that will challenge us. And they actually, then there is discussion of what might that look like and what are our vulnerabilities. And the extraordinary thing is the vulnerabilities are listed there in the discussion before the U.S. Senate. It was known what needed to be done. And the tragedy of this is that we did not do it as a world and as a country.
Let's talk a little bit about the you mentioned that sort of the that modernity has created these sort of pathways, right? That sort of dictate the flow, if you will, of a pandemic. What about how wealth inequality? What about the sort of the, you know, when we talk about modernity, we're talking about, you know, technology in terms of travel and advances in some areas and not in others. But what about sort of the, and I guess, you know, I'm trying not to limit it to my perspective in the United States, but broadly speaking, this is an issue around the globe. How does like wealth inequality implicate that?
I'm delighted that you raised that, because that is another part of our globalized world, which is to say that since the Second World War, the inequality between social classes has broadened exponentially through the industrial world on the one hand, and between the developed nations of the industrial world and the developing nations of the industrial world. And so you have two fault lines of inequality. One, if you like, within the, let's look at the example of the United States. And initially it looked as though, it sounds as though a disease transmitted through the air is, should we say, a democratic equal opportunity infection. It's true. It can make anyone ill. All you have to do is be present at the wrong time at the wrong place and to be breathing, and you breathe in the air exhaled by a patient. You share that air and you incorporate the microbes into your lungs. So that can happen to anyone. And initially it seemed as though skiers, holidaymakers, we heard about Prince Charles, Boris Johnson, Tom Hanks, it seemed elite members of society were very vulnerable. But actually, that's misleading. That was the early part of the disease. And what we've seen since is that it is, in fact, people who are impoverished, who are disadvantaged economically, who are overwhelmingly becoming sick and dying. If you look at the figures from Manhattan, it clearly shows, or New York City as a whole, that you can map the virus victims by illness or death over the disadvantaged zip codes. Yep. And it's those places that are particularly suffering. And African Americans and Hispanics in New York City have experienced this disease, contracting it at twice the rate of the white population of New York City. And this is happening for really simple reasons. One, the lack of access to medical care. And that if you live in a inner city ghetto and you don't have the possibility of doing what we've all been told, which is to practice social distancing. How do you social distance in an overcrowded housing development in which not only do you share the common space with lots of people, but also in addition to that, there is terrible hygienic conditions, and washing your hands and all of that is not really so easy. So domestically, it's a major issue that this is preferentially attacking people, the poor, and the poor have a greater burden of pre-existing conditions of obesity, heart disease, high blood pressure, that in so many cases, if they're not covered by insurance, they aren't being treated for those. So those are good reasons that the poor in our country are suffering. But then if you look on the international level, it's also entirely the case that we're seeing this disease, which started in China, then moved to Europe, and then over to North America, it's now moving, rampaging in the poorer countries of the world. And this brings into question the fact that over decades, those countries relative, I don't mean they're becoming poor absolutely, but relatively compared to the industrial world, there is a process of a growing distance in advantages. And you have, imagine preaching the idea of social distancing in the favelas of Rio de Janeiro, right, or in the townships of South Africa, or in the shawls of Mumbai, where it's impossible because of the extraordinary overcrowding, the lack of guaranteed water, the lack of soap. All of those mean that this disease is running rampant in the third world, and it's setting off as a secondary, very possible consequence, one that the UN has sounded an alarm. This may lead to massive famine in Africa and in Latin America, and social calamities and tensions and all that follow in their wake. So poverty, we can't really discuss this disease with accurately and explain its epidemiology unless we include poverty within it.
As you were saying that, I mean, I want to turn a little bit to maybe not so much what we can expect in the wake of something like this, or maybe so, but also like, you know, what history teaches us then. But as you were talking about the favelas in Rio, I'm reminded of the response to things like cholera in the 1800s in France. And could you touch on that and just sort of like how these pandemics can be exploited or reacted to? I mean, I would imagine there's a slate of sort of generic responses that run from in the wake of these things that I want to talk about that, you know, that range from, I would imagine, you know, like to paranoia or maybe some communalization of society, or maybe the opposite. Speak specifically about how like pandemics have been exploited in the past to, it's usually by the powerful versus the least powerful.
Right. I would say that an essential feature of the history of pandemics is that they're not simply interchangeable causes of death and suffering. They are actually all individuals. They're all horrible. I mean, it's if I say individuals, it's a terribly dysfunctional family, if you like. But the point is that they're not the same, and their impacts, their legacy on society, and the people they strike are really very different. And the disease that spreads...
Is that a function, is that a function of the nature of the disease? Because that causes us to remap society in certain ways? Or is that a function of the specific context in which the disease hits?
Right. I think it's a combination of the two. So that diseases that are, let us say, purely transmitted easily through the air, smallpox, for example, in its time, really did strike everyone and anyone. It was, whereas a disease transmitted through contaminated food and water like typhoid, or the example you gave of cholera, that really is overwhelmingly a disease of the poor rather than of the wealthier classes who live in an entirely different urban environment. They may live in the same city, but they live in large, spacious houses, well served with pure water supplies. They did in the 19th century too, and they live spaciously, and they have high cleanliness standards. So they're, although they live in the same city, they, the wealthy and the poor in the 19th century, they actually inhabited different worlds. So that if you look at who was struck in Paris, the example of France, or in Naples, an example of Italy, or Hamburg in Germany, one sees that this really is a disease of working people rather than of the wealthy. It's they who succumb to Asiatic cholera. And this in turn has a knock-on effect. That is to say, if a disease is clearly following, if its class predilections are obvious and almost without exceptions, then the poor are begin to wonder if this is actually a natural event, or is this in fact something that is being manipulated, that is being fostered by wealthy and powerful people to rid themselves of a social problem. And so, and then at the same time, if there was in the 19th century, people didn't understand at that time in the way that we do about microbes and how they're spread. And so there were, in people's minds, there were alternative epidemiologies. The poor thought in terms of a class plot, and the wealthy classes thought in terms of filth. And filth is part of the dangerous classes who had risen up so often during the early Industrial Revolution and riots and even in revolutions at numerous times. And so there was a fear of working people. And the fact that they had now become, with cholera, medically dangerous as well, really sharpened class tensions. And we see this in the brutal, it's not only cholera, obviously. I'm saying this is added on to other issues, economic, political, religious, all kinds of tensions, but the cholera exacerbates them. And I think that's part, as you were saying, of the violence of the repression of the revolutions in 1849, in which middle classes and upper classes and aristocracy saw an opportunity to put down the dangerous classes who had threatened them so severely in 1830, 1848, and in numerous riots since. And in 1871, the repression of the Paris Commune is actually almost a 19th century precursor of ethnic cleansing in our own time. And I would say that the issue of disease rather sharpened the edges of social tensions that were already there and, of course, pre-existed the cholera and had other causes. And were the root causes, but I would say that the cholera sharpened those edges and made the conflict much more violent and intense.
I know that you don't necessarily address the Spanish flu too much in your book, but do you think that there is, or maybe even from cholera, do you think there is embedded in our sort of social DNA, if you will, our attitudes towards, you know, our attitudes in terms of like, you know, people living in poverty or the working class or the aristocracy, as it were. I mean, how much of our worldview it can be traced to events like this in the past that we form these sort of ideas that get sort of like, just built into our sense of society and of people.
Right. I'm happy to talk about Spanish flu, 1918. The reason being that it really is a counterexample. It's a really good counterexample of a disease transmitted through the air, a pulmonary disease that you get from breathing the same air as people who already have the disease. And that disease, I think, is the best example I can think of what might be called a really democratic disease. It was a disease that afflicted more or less all social classes, and it passed through communities and more or less struck everyone. And so it didn't contribute to social tensions of the kind that we've been describing. And it's interesting that it left, in a way, despite its massive mortality, it killed enormous, some people estimate, as many as 100 million people worldwide, far more people than the First World War at the same time killed. And yet, it's written about as a leading historian of these events, writes in his title of his book, America's Forgotten Pandemic. And that really is true around the world, that this pandemic didn't leave a lasting legacy. People were much more preoccupied with the First World War and the peacemaking and the Bolshevik Revolution, all of which were around the very same time. And then the disease didn't besiege communities the way the coronavirus is doing, or the bubonic plague, or even cholera did. It passed rapidly through communities, making everyone sick and killing a sizable but limited number of people. And so it was this rapid passage of the disease that was another factor that meant that people it didn't exploit those social tensions in a way that the coronavirus, which is besieging communities, is doing at this very moment.
And that's fascinating. I mean, I've become aware of, obviously, the past 6 weeks or so about how much in this country, the psyche has sort of flushed that from the system. Did the Spanish flu in any way implicate all of those other events that were going on? Because I learned from your book that the Haitian rebellion was the outcome of the Haitian rebellion, and even like Louisiana Purchase was in some way a function of yellow fever.
Yes. With regard to Haiti, it's important to realize that it's not always that pandemic diseases strengthen authoritarianism. And indeed, one of the features of the Haitian rebellion is that what happened is that there was a story of differential immunity. Haiti was the most wealthy colony in the world. It's hard to imagine that now, but at the early 19th century it was, because of its enormously productive sugar plantations. During the French Revolution, with the neutralization of French power, there was an enormous slave rebellion that was led in the end by Toussaint Louverture. Napoleon, after a regime change in France, emerges as the emperor at the end of the revolution, and he decides that he wants to restore the sugar plantation economy built on slavery, African slavery, to Haiti because of its wealth, because he wants to use it as a base to reproject French imperial ambitions back onto North America. And he's actually not at all happy with this world turned upside down and the rebellion led by Africans. He was a racist at his time. So this yellow fever, in fact, is a disease that Europeans had no immunity to. Africans, on the other hand, had a degree of herd immunity, as we're calling it now, to the yellow fever. And so Napoleon sent this huge armada of 60,000 troops to Haiti, soldiers and sailors. By the middle of the summer, after he sent them in the early spring, the French commander wrote back to Paris that 80% of his soldiers and sailors had died of this one cause, not combat, but of yellow fever, and that the remaining 20% of his soldiers and sailors were convalescing and therefore useless for military activity. And so there was no alternative to surrender. And so we have, as a result, overwhelmingly, of the yellow fever, the victory of the slave rebellion. And so in 1804, we have the proclamation of Haiti as the first independent Black republic in the world. This is the beginning, really, of decolonization. It's also a major blow to African slavery in the New World. And because Haiti was lost, Napoleon felt that it was no longer possible to promote French power in North America. And so he sold French territories, which were called Louisiana, to Thomas Jefferson. And so in 1803, we have the Louisiana Purchase that doubled the size of the United States. So we see this event promoting decolonization, slave rebellion, a first Black republic in the history of the world, geopolitical change, the neutralization of French power in North America, and France begins to look, Napoleon looks eastward rather than westward, and it makes the United States now a major power within the Americas, and it sets it on the path to becoming what we know as a global power. So all of this was part of the legacy of yellow fever. These diseases, in other words, can have a truly transformative effect on society. And I think we're seeing the potential for that in the coronavirus that we're experiencing at the moment.
I want to touch on maybe the sort of those potentials or the silos in which we should look to. But before we get to that, let me just ask you about tuberculosis, because that I found fascinating that at one point it was perceived as a status symbol to get TB. Will you just touch on that? I found that fascinating. And then I want to go back to sort of, you know, round it out with the areas in which we should look for change in the wake of this. But tell us that story of TB, because that's I found fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. I'll talk then very briefly about TB in the first half of the 19th century. After the discovery and proof of the germ theory of disease, the story changes and we see something very different happening. But until, say, the 1880s and 90s, the reigning the ideas in people's heads matter too. And the reigning interpretation of tuberculosis was that it was hereditary, that you got tuberculosis because of your inherent constitution, and it wasn't, you were therefore innocent in a way. And the symptoms of tuberculosis were those that in Victorian ideas and certain religious ideas were very in a consonant with the idea that this wasted away the flesh. It was a disease overwhelmingly of the lungs, and it wasted away the vulgar flesh, and you became thin and pale. And so the thought was that you actually became, it promoted your intelligence. And it was seen that tuberculosis affected the wealthy, prosperous, the elite of the 19th century. It struck Keats and Shelley and Chopin and Paganini. And so it was thought to be a disease that was going to, that promoted glory of people's intellect and intelligence. Victor Hugo was told by his friends that although he was a great writer, it was a pity he didn't have tuberculosis, because he'd then have been an even greater writer. And feminine beauty, one can see this, was redefined as looking like a tubercular patient. And so it was the fashion then to be very thin and slender You painted your face as a woman with rice powder so that you'd look pale, and you wore fashions that made you look thin and with a narrow waist, and you would even cultivate a lisp in your speech, and you might cough just lightly. And so we see a heroine like Mimi, the tuberculous heroine of opera, and thinking of the United States, if you read People Forget, Uncle Tom's Cabin is not only about slavery, it's also a novel about tuberculosis, and you get this romantic picture of a beautiful death of the heroine through tuberculosis. And tuberculosis is a horrible way to die. You asphyxiate in the fluids in your lungs, and so it's painful and awful. But this was presented by Harriet Beecher Stowe as a beautiful disease that ennobled the heroine, and she became a more lovely, more ethereal. And there was even a book at the turn of the century by an American commentator about the United States who, as the disease was just beginning to recede, he had a terrible anxiety. This would mean that the arts, the culture, the sciences were all going to decline in the United States because tuberculosis nurtured genius, and the population of the United States clearly would no longer be able to experience that. So this was the idea of what tuberculosis was amazingly in the early decades of the 19th century, down through the middle and late decades. And it all changed when tuberculosis was found to be, in fact, a disease of poverty, a disease that disproportionately affected the poor. It was called in public health, they really stressed, it's a disease not of the beautiful people, but of the ugly and filthy people. And you get then a beginning of stigmatizing the tuberculous, and the idea hotels would no longer admit people with a cough. The states in the west of the United States tried to keep people who had coughs from moving to take the so-called better air in the mountains, or even to go to sanatoria there. So it changes with how it's the way society reacted to tuberculosis really reflected a major change in the understanding of the disease, and one that promoted stigma and social, I don't want to say social distancing, that term's been right, adopted for something else, but it really created emphasized class barriers. Let's put it that way.
I mean, and that sort of leads into this conversation about the different way, where, you know, directions where we could head in the wake of this. I mean, it's fascinating to me. I mean, you know, I get the dynamic of, okay, once you find out that it's actually something you can catch, you don't want it. Once you realize like it's not fate that you're going to get this, or not, that it's actually your actions, you don't want it. And I can understand how you step away from it. I don't know how you get from, I have the gene for TB and therefore I am elite. But okay, I guess, you know, that's a different era maybe. But so what, in the wake of this, what are the, obviously it's impossible to predict exactly, you know, what the implications of however long we have to maintain some measure of social distancing or whatever it is, it takes its form. But in the wake of this, like, what are the, almost the lenses that we should be using to look out for? What are the silos of our society that we would see reflected, where we would see potential change and things that we should be looking out for if we were to have this knowledge? I mean, just make it easier and to say, what are the things that you're looking at based upon your knowledge of the history of pandemics and their aftermath?
Right. As you say, it's dangerous to make predictions about COVID-19. After all, it's been a human disease literally just since December, and it's very early. much more is not understood about the disease than is understood. And we don't know how long it's going to last. We don't know if there will be an effective vaccine or treatment. We don't know if it will be affected by the change of seasons. We don't know if it will mutate and evolve. We don't know if it will come in waves, the way, say, the Spanish influenza did, or whether it will become endemic and we have to live with it long term. All of those are, we don't know how catastrophic its economic impact will be on the global economy. It's still too early. But it seems to me there are these silos, if you phrased it, these areas of society that seem to me that will, that I'm certainly preoccupied with. And it seems to me that we as a society will need to think about. One is clearly the way cities are planned and viewed. And it's interesting to note that the city of Milan is already adopting the view that this is likely to become a long-term disease that we have to live with, like influenza, that is seasonal influenza, and that it's therefore imperative that cities be rethought. And so they're doing some of the rethinking. One of the ideas is that people should be able long-term to practice social distancing. So they're doubling, tripling the size of sidewalks so that people will be able to shop while keeping large distances. They're trying to create as well major bicycle lanes. The reason for that is partly to reduce urban smog, but also even to keep people from taking the subway system in Milan, because they estimate that 85% of the users of the subway system go to work less than 3 miles away. And so they really might be able to be lured, knowing that after this experience with the virus, that it's much safer and socially responsible in all sorts of ways to take their bicycle instead of public transport. So we can see that the knock-on effect then is reimagining cities, reimagining our transportation system. And that includes the air transportation system, not just subways. It will mean a macroeconomic rethinking, because it's clear that the environmental history of our planet coincides and is inseparable from the public health history of our world. And that if you have the creation of enormous smog, and if you destroy the environment, the habitat of animal life, then you are creating the preconditions for the prospering of respiratory diseases. So we're going to have to rethink our economy in order to have a green economy that doesn't expose us in the long term, because this coronavirus, horrible though it is, it isn't the last word that nature will speak to us. And I believe nature is delivering a very powerful message that this is something to which our world, this kind of disease, not just this particular disease, this category of disease, is one to which we remain enormously vulnerable. And nature has delivered that message. And I think that we would be totally irresponsible and stupid or crazy not to listen carefully. We'll have to think, I think work will be rethought. We've seen that already, that whole categories of work have been brought more or less to a halt, and it doesn't look as though it's going to be easy to go back or proper to go back to what happened before. And so many, many more people are likely to be working at home. The whole tourist industry will have to be rethought and reconfigured. I believe the relationship between the wealthy countries and the world of the world and the third world countries will have to be thought. I believe that our whole private healthcare system in our country will need to be rethought, because we're enormously vulnerable, because our private healthcare, viewing health as a commodity, never created what's needed an enormous emergency like that, a private hospital wants to have full occupancy of the beds, and the equipment should be used up to the limit as possible. Whereas a public health emergency demands planning in advance for spare beds, surge capacity, for protective equipment, for the healthcare providers, for ventilators that are beyond the needs of the moment, but are kept in supply for an emergency, bigger capacity in IC units, training of the healthcare personnel and providing them with a safe working environment and safe equipment to preserve their health. All of these things will need to be changed, as will the provision of healthcare for everyone, because healthcare depends. It depends on science. Modern public health depends on the medical authorities knowing and tracking where the disease is in real time, and that cannot be done if 30 million and more people are not within the system because they have diseases that doctors and the healthcare system know nothing about. And so a disease like coronavirus can be flourishing in the uncovered, those uncovered by the healthcare system enormously and not be detected by the healthcare system. That is an enormous vulnerability, and that will also need to be dealt with. So I see enormous rethinking of our economy and of our economic model for how a capitalist system works. I see reimagining our cities. I see reimagining what work is like and how we carry it out, get to it, and home again. I see thinking about our international relations and rethinking our healthcare system. I also would add to that, maybe we ought also to rethink our legal system, because one of the features of the privacy laws is that it was impossible for municipal health authorities to trace practice contact, because those health in the healthcare system were not able to communicate who was ill and who wasn't. And so it wasn't possible to try to create social distancing by providing temporary accommodation for patients. It wasn't possible to identify the patients because of the legal system environment in which we do our business in the United States. That's another that feature. And then I'm really worried, lastly, about the preparation of our leaders for such catastrophic events. And it seems to me that we have greater requirements for teenagers to drive cars than we do for leadership to be president of our country or governor of a state or mayor. And it seems to me that part of their preparation for having this enormous responsibility is understanding public health, so that they will be in a position actually to lead and at the very least to understand the reports that they're receiving and help listen to their advisors to respect science. And that's part of it as well, because we live in a world in which so many sectors of our society don't believe in Darwinian evolution, or don't believe in climate science, or believe that this isn't COVID-19. This is an Asian, almost going back like to the tuberculosis right. idea of the early 19th century, that this is part of Chinese people's DNA rather than something that you get because you're at the wrong place at the wrong time. And so I think that we need to reconsider all of that, the role of science in our society, and the fact that science isn't the enemy. It can create technology that's devastating, but it is also part, scientific public health is part of our survival kit as a country, as a civilization, and as a species.
Well, I can tell you, my daughter does not have her license yet, but she has had a couple of choice words for our president in terms of his ideas as of late. Professor Emeritus, Professor Emeritus of History and History of Medicine at Yale, Frank M. Snowden. The book is Epidemics in Society from the Black Death to the Present. We will put a link at majority.fm to that book. Thank you so much for your time today. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you. I've really been delighted to be with you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and head into the fun half. The bubonic plague, actually, one of the things we didn't get to in our conversation was one point, it was like in the mid-1600s in Strasbourg. I know they rounded up all the Jews in the town. I think there was a couple thousand. And basically accused them of having some type of, like, it was a religious thing. I basically said, renounce your religion or die. And about half were, I think, burned at the stake at that, like literally that day. It's on some level the modern day drink bleach in terms of the level of ignorance that's involved. Folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. Obviously, a lot of people going through financial stress. We'll be going through more financial stress in the coming months, perhaps even longer. If you are able to support this program, now would be a great time to do it. You can do so at jointhemajorityreport.com. You get the fun half. You get occasionally we'll do some other bonus stuff once we get a little settled in. I know it's been a month, but still. Any support you can give would be more than welcome and appreciated. Jointhemajorityreport.com. If you're one of those people who want the fun half, but you don't have the resources at this time, or if you're a member and you're worried about having the resources, you can either, if you're a member, head over to the cancellation page. We've got some options for you there. If you are someone who wants the fun half, send me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Give me a little time, but we will get to it and set you up. Also, don't forget the AM Quickie, 6-7 minutes of headline news in the morning, free at amquickie.com or on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever. Also on the app. You can get it at majorityapp.com. Check that out. You can listen to the show live. You can watch the show live. You can get the AM Quickie. You can search the membership. It's that app also is free for your use. Don't forget justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority. Get 10% off. I now know exactly how long it takes me personally to get through a 5-pound bag of the Majority Report blend. It's almost exactly a month, a little bit more. So enjoy. Also, don't forget TMBS tomorrow night. Last week was Cornell West. You can check it out at patreon.com/TMBS or The Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Also, tomorrow we'll be joining us. Nomaki Konst will be here. You can check out her show at patreon.com. The Nomaki Show or Nomiki Konst on YouTube. Matt, what's going on with the literary hangover? I think you just, I feel like we just heard part of this week's episode.
Very relevant episode this week. A Journal of the Plague Year by Daniel Defoe. So if you're looking for something to take your mind off coronavirus, this will not help. I refute that
because I feel like hearing about other pandemics did take my mind off of this.
I agree with that too. We talk about the surveillance state and how that advances during plagues. We talk about how feudal lords didn't take any better care of their workers during this than capitalist ones do. And a lot of things like that. It's amazing how much things stay the same. Turns out he talks about social distancing 6 feet under. Those sorts of regulations come from this time where you want to bury the people 6 feet under. which has a bit of echo to the 6 feet away thing, I thought a little bit. So yeah, patreon.com/literary hangover, folks.
We will talk about your camera angle in the...
I know.
Jamie. Jamie, you should know that there's a mic stand headed your direction.
Oh, wonderful. I mean, I kind of like holding my microphone like I'm a stand-up comedian, but it is harder to take notes when I'm holding it.
Randy Rhodes did that back in the day on Air America. So you're in good company in terms of broadcasting. What's happening on the Antifada this week?
Well, this week on the Antifada, we got a little bit distracted the past few weeks from doing a proper Bernie postmortem. We had more pressing matters like mutual aid and space dolphin communism. However, we will be finally doing a bit of a Bernie postmortem this week. Looking at the various institutional factors in why he was not ultimately successful at winning and kind of charting a course for where the left can go from here. Also, last week, we posted a new episode of The Vampire Castle, which is my side project with Leslie Lee from Struggle Session, wherein we talk about actual vampires, not social justice warriors. And in this episode, we talk about Buffy the Vampire Slayer and have kind of a comradely debate over whether or not the show holds up today, particularly the dialogue. So check that out, patreon.com/theantifada.
All right, quick break. See you in the fun half. Oh, wait, Matt. Matt, hold on. 1 second. Just need to remind people. I'm excited to introduce you to what is one of the coolest sponsors we've ever had, Hunt a Killer. It's a murder mystery subscription box. It's one of the most unique games out there and brings the fun of an escape room to your home. Go to hunttokiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority at checkout. You get 20% off your first box. It's hunttokiller.com/majority with promo code majority. Jamie, I get the sense this might be right up your alley. All right, see you guys in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
That's a good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already. Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.